Welcome back to another episode of the October Sky Minute podcast, a show where, in the Movies by Minutes tradition, we analyze, scrutinize, and celebrate the 1999 Joe Johnston-directed feature October Sky at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts, Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryant, an aerospace nerd from the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. And Jim, as we are just getting ramped up and onto this journey through October Sky, we, as always, you and I are beyond lucky in terms of the guests that we have and the contacts that we're able to make and the people we're able to track down and so generously give their time to talk to us. And we've got a great one today on this episode here for minute three. And that is somebody without whom this movie, any movie wouldn't happen without a screenwriter, right? Mm-hmm. So let's welcome Lewis Kolick. Screenwriter. Lewis, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you guys for having me.
Wow. Well, Lewis, we always go over what the minute's about. This minute three, starts with miners getting locked into their elevator as they're listening to news of Sputnik heading down into the mine as the AM radio slowly fades out. We get to the last of the titles at the of the opening here, where it says based on a true story. And then we see, three of the four Rocket Boys that we're going to be meeting. This is the intro to Roy Lee, Odell, and of course, our hero, Homer Hickam, who is heading off to, according to Odell, his own suicide. So we're going to find out where all this happens in Colwood, West Virginia, on October 5th, 1957. Before we get into all that, Lewis, where was the original contact point that you had with getting involved in writing the screenplay for this film?
Well, I, the producer, the late Chuck Gordon, I knew him very well, and he and I had done we'd done two pictures together, which is it's a lot. We did Unlawful Entry and we did Judgment Night. I knew his brother Larry Gordon, who very well, and we had a really good relationship. And Chuck just walked into my little office one day, and he said, "I've got something that I just think is extraordinary." And what he had was a Homer Hickam's book proposal for the book that he had sold and was in process of he was in the process of writing the book. So I don't know how much of the book Homer had at that point, maybe 50%, I don't know. But I read this book proposal. And the book proposal just knocked me out, as it had Chuck. It was just very emotional, very cinematic. You could see so much of what was there. It was an original story. It was beautiful. It was inspirational, and you cried at the end of it. And I mean, it was a book proposal, So we figured, if we can get this, if they can get this kind of reaction from a book proposal, we could really hit a grand slam with a movie. This is before there was Joe Johnston or anything like that. I mean, it was just Chuck coming into me saying, "Would you like to do this?" And I had to then get it sold, which happily I was able to do. And they paid me to write the screenplay, and the rest is we took it from there.
Well, since it was starting at the time that it was a book proposal, did you have contact with Homer while you were developing the screenplay and he was writing the book? Was that kind of simultaneous, or?
Yeah, we probably they probably made the introduction pretty early on in the process. Once I signed on, because I was frankly I was really intimidated by all the science of it, I mean, the guy is a rocket scientist, and I didn't have that kind of background like, maybe you guys did. I was not a science nerd at all, and I was intimidated by, all the technology that was going to have to go into this thing. But knowing that I would have access to Homer, and, I spoke to Homer, and we had a good introductory conversation. He answered all my questions along the way. And then there was some of this stuff, in the book, And then more and more and more came, the book came in parts. And eventually it was, but any question that I ever had about anything that might not even have been in the book, you know, there was a scene, for instance, in the movie where Homer's got to go up to the blackboard and prove scientifically that their errant rocket could not have been scientifically the responsible for having started the fire. He's going to have to go up to the blackboard and demonstrate the trigonometry why he believes that he was unjustly accused. And I needed Homer to do this for me. So he told me the equation. He told me how to write it and what to put on the blackboard. So it was, and I don't, that wasn't in the book because that never happened in the book. But it happens in the movie. So.
Yeah, yeah. This is coming. I mean, the film was coming on the heels of Ghosts of Mississippi, which, you know, you're obviously showing a forte at taking historical events, you know, large and small, and turning them into really compelling dramas. Were you working on Ghosts of Mississippi at the time you were also putting this together? How what's the overlap on those two productions?
I think I wasn't working. I think that I had gotten this famous book proposal while we were running around doing PR and press and screenings of Ghosts of Mississippi. That was already in it. I don't think it had been released yet, but we were going to premieres and stuff. Because I remember being with Rob Reiner, I think, on a plane coming back from Mississippi, and I told him about this next project that I was going to be working on, and he said, "Oh, that sounds cool." But there was no overlap in terms of going from one to the next.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Al.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, building on Jim's comment about you know, a number of things that you've worked on over the years that they're based on true stories or, you know, have some basis in historical fact. Yeah, you know, I've always wondered, and maybe specifically with October Sky, but when you're doing something like that, and you've elected to make a change, you know, we've got to deviate from reality. Maybe we're going to composite some characters, or we're going to compress a scene, or take a little license, move things around a little bit. Particularly with October Sky and working so directly with Homer Hickam, did you ever run into anything where you wanted to make a change and there was some resistance to it because he needed it to be, you know, much more like a documentary? Or do you ever encounter something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. We never asked Homer's permission for anything that we wanted to change, because, you know, you got to sign away your rights.
Right.
And we would never do anything that was, it's interesting because we would make changes big and small, only for the sole purpose of telling a story and for 2 hours and making it as cogently dramatic as we possibly could. And I can give you a big example. I can give you a small example of things that it really kind of took Homer a while, I think, to kind of see it from our point of view. Because I think once Homer came around to really kind of emotionally getting on board with the fact that, you know, you wrote a book, that's great, we got to do a movie, you know. And the response to the movie was always so gratifying and so great that Homer couldn't deny it. But, you know, there are issues that he had and probably continues to have, but he realizes the wisdom. He said as much to me. This is one of the smaller things. Homer said, when Homer goes back down into the mine, because his dad's been injured, he goes down and works in the mine, and, you know, some time has elapsed, and his dad is getting better and says, "Homer, I'm going to be able to, you're going to be able to go back," and because Homer's dropped out of school to go into the mine. And it was a very dramatic thing in the movie, which did not happen in the book, but Homer's working in the mine, and his dad says, "Homer, I'm okay now, and you've done a great job, and you can basically quit the mine and you can go back to school." And Homer says, well, Dad, you know, I'm going to be graduating pretty soon. And, you know, for home, he sees his life is going to be in a coal mine. He doesn't really see the point in going back and finishing high school. And and that's what he says to his mom and dad. Pretty much, I might as well stay down in the mines. And his mother just, she's shocked. This is awful. And she says, John, you know, Homer's dad. And Homer's dad says, Elsie, Homer's a man now. And he can make his own decisions. And if that's what he wants to do, then that's what he'll do. And his mother is furious and she storms out of the room. Okay. Homer tells me the real Homer. He tells me my dad would be rolling over in his grave. He would never in a billion years have sanctioned my leaving high school. And basically, I hate that moment.
Oh, wow.
And I wish you hadn't done it. And was I a dad then in 1990? Yeah, I had kids, but they were very little. And you know what Homer said to me at the time, I didn't think about it all that much because I knew we had to do it. It was a big point in the movie. It was a dramatic turning point. And, you know, a lot of what's going to happen later on in the movie is going to kind of revolve around this momentous kind of decision. But I realize it now from Homer's point of view that it would have been kind of hurtful for him to, for his dad to have acted in a way that was totally contrary to his true character. And I understand it, but that's what you have to do when you write a movie. You just have to do that, because writing a movie, I'm not saying it's rocket science, no pun intended. I'm not saying it's that at all, but I'll tell you, man, it is really, really, really hard. And, you know, when you're writing a novel, you can write 1,000 pages if you want to, you know. When you're writing a movie, you got 2 hours and you have to tell that story, and it's got to be entertaining. I hate to use that word, but if you're not involved with these characters and their journey and this narrative that's laid out before you, you can lose people. And you know, there was a time when this movie was not a sure thing ever by any stretch of the imagination. You know, Universal was not dying to do a period drama about a bunch of kids, because there's not going to be any opportunity to cast a movie star or anything. How are you going to sell it? You know, and I wrote the first draft of October Sky. Again, this was long before there was Joe Johnson. I wrote the first draft of that, and it was truer to Homer's book in certain regard. I didn't take so many liberties. There are things I eliminated from the book because I couldn't put everything in. But, you know, so I wrote the first draft, and, you know, then you turn it in and you wait, and what is everybody going to say? And it's crucial that they like it. And the response was muted, you know, to they didn't hate it because the material was so beautiful. And I got the characters right and all that, you know, but their response was muted because the story just wasn't dramatic enough. You know, it was just kind of missing something. And they weren't real helpful. They didn't say do this or do that. They were just telling me to, they was basically saying go figure it out, you know.
But make it more interesting.
Make it more dramatic.
Yeah.
Because this is not really grabbing us. And I remember I lived in a different house at the time, when I walked around my room like 100 times just thinking, like, what am I going to do? And I had, you know, in screenwriting terms, I will say it was really nothing short of I had an epiphany. And from the moment I kind of, this light bulb went off in my head, I knew how this movie was going to go and what would help. And it led to this moment that I'm talking about Homer's dad saying, you can come go back to school if you want. And you know, the moment is, it's not a moment in the movie, it's a big deal. It's Homer's decision in the first place to drop out of school and go down into the mine and take his father's place in the mine and work down in the mine to save his brother's scholarship and to continue to help put food on the table. He's going to quit school and give up his dreams, and he's going to go into the mine. That didn't happen, you know, but that gave the movie so much more of a dramatic interest, of a real, oh my God, kind of like what's going to happen to Homer? We love this kid, and he's so smart, he's so dedicated, and this is his dream, and he's going to lose his battle, and he's going to go into the mine. So it really gave us so much to work with. But you know, it led to some criticism from people who love the book. They thought that was a liberty that they didn't appreciate, and you know, Homer didn't particularly appreciate it for a while either. But like I said, you know, the power of that movie became undeniable. People just loved it, you know, and that's one of the reasons why they loved it, because it gave them a story that they could continually, they were involved with from start to finish.
I keep wondering if there's more people that were drawn to the movie after reading the book, or more people that were drawn to reading the book after the movie. I know for me, I hadn't read the book until I'd seen the movie, and then I had to go get the book immediately. Like you said, you had to compress and combine some characters, but that's, you've got 102 minutes of film that you have to fit a 300-page story into. So it worked for me.
Absolutely.
I would think that one of the bigger characters that you had to get rid of, and of course now the name just dropped out of my head, but the fellow from Ohio who gave, you know, who brought the telescope and would be on top of the clubhouse and things like that. I think you boiled him down to the guy that was in the Corvette on the road for like about a 30-second piece in the film. He was like kind of a view of the outside world, but he really isn't necessary in telling this story because he's not. And not a part of it, really.
Let me tell you something. The first time I knew immediately, okay, you know, how am I going to do this? There's a great moment in the book. And I don't know where it falls in the book, maybe at the end. But, you know, young John F. Kennedy is running for Senate. And he comes into West Virginia. Yeah. He's giving a speech. And Homer Hickam is there along with everybody else. And in the course of the speech, he's asking for, you know, what would you people like from your government? What would you like to see in the future? And Homer says, I'd like to see a man go to the moon. And John Kennedy said, wow, young man, I will really give that some serious consideration, you know. Okay, it's a great moment. I'd like to see young John Kennedy rolling into Colwood. I'd love to see that. But it's very problematic. You can't really do it. Why? You know, because why can't you do it? Because Sputnik went up in 1957. John Kennedy didn't come into West Virginia, you know, and campaign until 1960. So that means this movie is going to have to span 3 years if you want to do that. And I said, this movie is just not the kind of material that can span 3 years. So that's going to fall out. That's not going to be in the screenplay. So those are the kind of decisions that you have to make all the way through. You know, I love my favorite part of the book. It's not there. Well, not saying it wasn't great, and it wouldn't have been great in a movie, but, you know, it took place 10 years before the movie took place, you know, began. There's all kinds of things like that. So it's very, very difficult. But I love it, and I'm very proud particularly of the way this one turned out and of the decisions that we all made jointly. And
when you're staring at a blank page, you're at page one and you're rolling up and you've already typed the title and your screenplay by, and you type in your name and then you're about to head into it. Are you working off of, like, do you outline it? I'm thinking, like, you know, do you pull out your dog-eared copy of Sid Field and say, okay, here's what we're going to do with Act One, Act Two, Act Three, or where does that come from in your process?
Yeah, I write. By the time I write what you said, the title page, I feel like I've already written the movie. I feel like now I'm just kind of taking kind of what's been in my head, and I'm putting it onto paper, because I have a very thorough, detailed outline. There's dialogue in it, not the complete dialogue, although when I'm writing a scene for the outline, I say, okay, here's a scene where Homer gets into a fight with his father about, he's quitting the mine, right? So I'll write that scene. And if I have dialogue that just kind of comes into my head, I'll put it down. But I don't write the entire scene, but every scene in that movie, in any movie that I've ever written, it's got act one, yeah, Sid Fields, whatever, whoever you want to refer to. And there's an act break 30 minutes in, and something that turns it into act two. And here's act two when it's going to build to act three. I have all that on 10 or 15 pages, you know.
Wow.
And it's pretty detailed. Because usually October Sky, not so much. I didn't have to sell October Sky that much, because the guy who had just taken over running the studio, I knew him, and he knew me, and he wanted to be in business with me and Chuck, of course. And he probably had his reader read the book, so we basically knew what it was going to be about. And I said, it's going to be kind of like a breaking away kind of movie, you know, which I love. And he loved, and he said, oh, breaking away, great, go do it, you know. Usually it's not that easy. He was flush with cash because he had just gotten his job, and Universal was in a good position. And, you know, like I say, wanted to work with Chuck and I. But usually, you know, if you have a unless the studio already owns it and they're hiring you, even then, like if your studio owns a piece of material, they want to know, well, how are you going to turn this into a movie? You know, what are you going to do? And I usually have to go in and tell them a movie story for, 10 or 15 minutes, you know, fade in. This is what happens, you know. In the end of act one, you know, the guy finds out that his wife has been having an affair with his best friend, whatever, you know. Act two, you know, they want to know the story. So I have to figure out the story. So that's, you know, I did it on October Sky. I did it on Ghost of Mississippi. I've done it on pretty much everything I've ever done. That doesn't mean that you're kind of a slave to your outline, and you'll get to points in the outline with, oh my God, this doesn't work at all. What do I do now? So what was I thinking when I came up?
Who wrote this anyway?
It's ridiculous. So, you know, you have to grapple with those kinds of issues all the time. But yeah, in answer to your question, I have a pretty detailed outline before I start writing the movies.
You know, something I'm curious about too, and again, it's about your process. You going through and doing this detailed outline, which is, as you said, you get to the end of that, you feel like it's already been written. And it's almost like when you're sitting down to write the screenplay, you're almost just sort of transcribing what's already there. But when you're doing the outline, do you do that pretty linearly? Are you doing that in order?
Yeah.
I'm asking in part because I write magazine features for a living, and it's, you know, it's nonfiction stuff. So I don't really have to make anything up. In fact, I get in trouble when I do. One of the things when I'm stuck with a story is a lot of times I'll write my ending first. And then that does this psychological thing to me where I'm convinced, okay, I've written the ending. It's basically finished. Now I just have to fill in a few other gaps. So I'm not comparing you and me by any stretch of anybody's imagination, but I'm just sort of curious about whether you go through it linear. And you said that you did. You're not really jumping around very much, or do you ever jump ahead to the end and feel like, okay, this is how we're going to wrap it up. Now, how am I going to get there, weave my way to it?
That's usually how I do write. I know where it ends. And everything else is, how do I get here? You know,
okay.
How do I get to? I know this is the ending of this movie. His father and his son are going to stand there, going to watch this rocket go up, and they're going to have this reconciliation that needs to happen between these two people. You know, how do I get there? How do I get there? So the whole script is a journey. Is their journey from being on polar opposites of pretty much everything in life to, you know, at this point where Homer says, I'm pretty much like you and you're my hero. How am I going to get there? You know, Now, I will tell you, maybe this is more has to do with, you know, the kind of writing that you do. But there's a writer who I don't know if he's be your cup of tea or not. His name is George Sanders. And he's a short story writer that I just kind of happened upon because he was on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert a few nights ago. And Stephen Colbert, who I think is just an exceptionally brilliant, funny guy. He was so high on this writer who I never heard of. I said, that I read the guy is George Sanders. I recommend him to everybody. He's very unusual. He's very unique. He's a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant writer. And what he was talking about on the show, which I said, wow, that's really interesting. He says, I don't like to know where my stories are going to end. When I'm writing them, I have no idea where they're going, how they're going to end. It's a surprise, always a beautiful, wonderful surprise to me when I get to the end of a story. I never know where it's going. And I said, that's like the exact opposite of everything I've ever done, everything I've thought. But man, it sure works for this guy. He's a greater writer than I will ever hope to be. It's just interesting. Maybe I'll try that sometime.
Yeah, try it and see what happens.
Before I hang up my spurs.
And that was George Sanders.
You can't do it when you're George Sanders. You can't do it when you're a gun for hire. The movie studio, you can't go in and how are you going to do this? He said, well, I don't know how it's going to end. You can't
that doesn't go over well at the pitch meeting.
I don't know, we'll just see what
happens. We'll find out together. We'll be on this journey together.
It's a bad time to call action. Good luck. One thing when we were mentioning Sid Field earlier, and one of the things that he had pointed out in screenwriting, well, he was quoting Joseph Campbell talking about how every character, like most screenplays, if a really good screenplay is character based, that you're following the characters and you figure out where that character is going. But every character needs to, it's the death of the old self and the coming of a new self in the storyline. And it seems like, I mean, watching this movie over and over again, you have an arc for everybody in this film. Every single person in this film seems to have this growth arc that is just amazing. Nobody, I'm trying to think, I'm using enough negatives on this. Nobody doesn't not change. It's like,
wait, I'm going to go to the blackboard and do some trigonometry and parse that real quick, Jim. Yes. Let's get Homer on the phone. But
I mean, even down to Roy Lee, Quentin, and all the Rocket Boys have their own little arcs. Even their teacher, the principal, everybody has this change of heart in the thing. And it's just, I was getting to the point where I was just wondering if you just wrote down every character name and said, well, what is this? How is this person going to change? Because it just seems like it flowed out of, it seemed very organic, but it just seems like everybody's getting their wagon fixed. I don't know if that came up consciously.
I'm really not as schematic as all that. I mean, it's really not. I mean, I knew where Homer and his, it's essentially the father and son story,
Yeah.
So how far everybody else is going to kind of orbit around that relationship, and they're going to change as those two people change, as that whole thing develops. And I didn't know exactly where it was all going. I mean, Miss Riley, the teacher, that was kind of a more obvious one, I guess. But, as far as the peripheral, more peripheral characters, I just let them be around Homer and see how the relationships were going to develop, especially the kids. Quentin was really, really one of my favorite characters. The scene where Homer walks up to him in the cafeteria.
Everybody has that pregnant pause.
And the only reason that really works is because of Joe Johnston. I mean, I wrote the scene, but he put it on film, and it's just great. You just feel it. But you could see how Quentin, who's so much smarter, IQ wise, he really is a brainiac. And here's these guys. They don't know anything, really. but he comes to love and respect them, especially Homer, because Homer's got this passion, his vision, his wisdom that Quentin, he's an IQ guy, but he begins to buy into it and it kind of lights him up. I mean, one of my favorite shots in the entire movie is when they go to and they walk 8 miles because his dad threw him out of town. So they go to his place, which they're going to call Cape Colwood, and plant their flag at Cape Colwood. And Homer's running around like, you know, the launch pad's going to go here and the sighting tower's going to go here and this will go here and that'll go there. And he's just like, you know, and Joe puts the camera on Quentin's face, watching Homer, and his face lights up with his beatific smile. Like, man, this is what life is all about. This is just beautiful. And, you know, it's things like that make the movie cumulatively have the power that it does. But those kids, you know, they all just end up going on this journey with Homer. And of course, his dad is the launch pad in a way for the journey.
We're talking out of our minutes, but we're going to. But one of my favorite parts, the writing in it was the translation scene where Quentin's explaining what he needs to do in the nozzle, and he's getting interpreted so that other people can understand his English. But
that's the kind of thing. That's the kind of thing that wouldn't be in an outline that I would write at all. You know, that wouldn't be, my mind is not that facile. I would just have a general idea for the scene without have to go and tell Ike Boykovsky, you know, we need this, we need that. You know, then you get into the scene, what are you going to do? And then, you know, these characters that have been kind of living in you for a while now, they just take over, you know. And so I'm glad you point that scene out, because I like this scene a lot. It's very funny.
there's so many that they kind of bubble up after you've seen the movie. I think that's one of the signs of a great screenplay, is that you just suddenly remember these other scenes that crop up. And I was wondering, when, from the time that you had turned in your, you know, as the final draft of before shooting began, how big were the changes when you were actually going to filming? Were you on set with Joe during production?
I was only on set for about 4 or 5 days. And, you know, I could have been there as long as I wanted, but, you know, I had life back here, and writers is real. And, you know, unless obviously the script is kind of a work in progress and we need a writer here to be on set and come up with stuff every day. That was the opposite case here. You know, the script was written. Joe wasn't going to make changes. He didn't need me to make changes. I was just there to kind of, you know, be there and look at it. I don't think I had anything much to offer. It was really Joe's film, my script and Joe's film. And from the time that I gave Joe the script, there were a couple of things. I can't even remember what they were that might have got changed or tweaked. And Joe put in a couple of additional things that he did by himself, because there were things that one was something in the book that I should have put in and I didn't. So Joe put it in. And one was a scene they're all sitting in the class, in the chemistry class. And all kids, you know, while the teacher is lecturing, the kids are all, you know, the Rocket Boys are together and they're talking about their ingredients and what they're going to do the next time. And then the teacher says, you know, okay, class, and everybody, oh, and they just dump it down into the sink. And then somebody lights a match and it comes out all the Bunsen burners. That's so great. That's not in the script. I don't know when Joe thought of it, but I'm glad he did. It's just really wonderful. But there was not a lot of sitting around working on a script, Joe and I together. Just wasn't necessary.
So, Lewis, do you recall when you first saw a cut of the film? Did you see multiple early cuts? And how does that how'd that work out for you?
It was really, really scary, because we had a couple of test screenings and they weren't going out well, and you could see it was all on the screen, but the pace was just not there, you know. It wasn't moving as fast as it needed to. So it got fixed in the editing room. And I, you know, there were some suggestions that I had. But we had, you know, we had a brilliant editor. And Joe's a great editor. I had a couple of suggestions, but we just took out the fat, and it's really all it was. I think we had maybe three test screenings. I think it was something like three. The first one was not great. It was kind of scary. You know, we were looking at each other like, you know, uh-oh. And the second one was maybe a little bit better, but we weren't there, you know. And then we had a test screening in La Cunada, if anybody knows where that is. And I'm telling you, the audience was on their feet. People were yelling and screaming and cheering, and that movie just worked. And yeah, you know, Universal would say, you know, at the time, this movie tested better than any movie we've ever had, but they didn't know how to sell it. And that became clear when the movie opened. They didn't know how to sell it. But yeah, it was not an immediate like, wow, this movie is going to be great. It was like, oh, we better figure out how to make this, you know, because it ain't working.
You could tell that they didn't know what to do with it just by looking at the poster, because the poster doesn't tell you anything about what's going on in the film. It's like, what's the radar edition?
That's fine, because I have the poster right here. It says, you can see, sometimes one dream is enough to light up the whole sky. Based on an extraordinary true story. And, you know, the big selling point is from the producer of Field of Dreams. That's really what they were selling. Well, if you like Field of Dreams, you will like this. Take our word for it. Yeah. Right. They didn't know how to sell it. They were very, very happy that they even sunk the money into it and made the movie, because not everybody would have. And I think that's principally because of Joe, and they really wanted to have a relationship with him because he was a great director and a money director. And they wanted him to direct some big movies for them. So they gave him this one small one, you know. But they didn't have a clue. They had no idea how to sell it. And it's unfortunate because they should have platformed it. They should have put it out on a few screens and let word of mouth build and let the reviews build. And they just kind of chickened out on that strategy. They said, we better just get it out there and get whatever money we can get back at them. Because if we just put it on a couple of screens and the reviews are bad, we may not then be able to get the screens to go wider with it. So yeah, that's what happened. And people found their way to October Sky over the course of years, but it was, you know, I think it's one of the most underrated movies in American cinematic history. I really do. I think it's a great movie. It should have been nominated for a bunch of Oscars. Joe's contribution was, you know, just magnificent, and it should have been so acknowledged. And you know, it's one of those things.
Joe has said in the past, and I'm paraphrasing, but he said, this is a movie that if you're a grown man who's ever had a father, and you're not and you're not crying at the end of this movie, you have no heart. And he's right. I mean, it's like, if you're not absolutely weeping by the time you walk out of this.
You want me to tell you a brief anecdote?
Sure.
That speaks exactly what you're saying. You know, when this movie was, after it had been out, it was making rounds on airplanes, you know, so it was playing on the plane going to Europe or wherever, you know, and my wife's boss at the time, he had come back from a flight, and he said, oh, Elizabeth, you know, Lewis's movie was playing on the plane and people were just crying. And we said, oh wow, that's nice. You know, okay, that's nice. So my wife and I went on a trip. I think we flew to Europe, and guess what? They're showing October Sky. You know, so it's kind of a weird feeling anyway, to be sitting there, you know, and everybody's watching your movie and nobody knows that you wrote it, you know, but there you are. And they're playing October Sky. And sitting in front of me is this younger guy, probably like, you know, in his 30s with his wife, I assume it was his wife. And they're watching the movie. I just see their heads, you know, and I'm sitting directly behind them. When that movie ended, this guy collapsed into this woman's shoulder, arms. Just fell over weeping, and she had to put her arm around him.
Wow.
That was the effect. And I saw this firsthand, right?
Wow.
It was very powerful.
Yeah, mission accomplished.
mission accomplished, yeah. I mean, the whole father-son dynamic is just, it calls to so many men who wish it had been this way, or maybe it had been that way, but it's deep inside us, for better or for worse. And this movie really, again, mines that. No pun intended.
No pun intended. So in that situation on the airplane, and you see that reaction, people in front of you, how do you resist the temptation to sort of lean forward and tap them on the shoulder and say, "Oh, did you like that?" You know, well, guess what? I wrote it. I mean, if I were sitting on the airplane and watching the film and the screenwriter was sitting behind me, I'd kick myself if I didn't know and didn't get a chance to turn around and say, "Hey, thank you."
Which, by the way, thank you. By the way, thank you for writing this, because this
absolutely
is,
yes.
Hal and I are both. Yeah, we turn into puddles every. Yeah, we have to watch this movie again and again and again.
So exactly, and it doesn't get any easier, darn it.
No, it's just.
Well, my daughter. I mean, she's 26 now, but she hadn't seen it until she was, I don't know, 15 or something. I said, "You haven't seen October Sky yet?" So she said, I want to watch it with you, Daddy. You know, I want to watch it with you, Dad. So I said, okay. And I felt like, you know, I've seen this movie 100 times. I really don't feel like seeing it again. I've seen it 100 times. And I sat there and I watched it with her. And it just affected me differently, because I guess I hadn't seen it in a while. And she was in tears, you know. And I was just moved by it all over again. And I went right into my office and I composed a letter to Joe, and I said, "Joe, you know, this movie is really beautiful, and thank you for making this movie. Your work in it is absolutely extraordinary, and I'm so proud that you know, my name is on this with yours, because, man, it's just a beautiful film." So yeah,
Joe told us we had previously done the Rocketeer Minute, and he said the Rocketeer was his favorite movie to make, but he said that October Sky to him is his most heartfelt movie. It really does capture. I mean, if you were giving somebody an elevator pitch about the movie, the ostensible thing is a boy learns how to, you know, wins the science fair in Indianapolis and gets to go to college. But it's a lot like I keep thinking of that. The thing about Mary Poppins, when you watch Mary Poppins, you think it's about Mary Poppins, but as the later movie they made about it, it's Saving Mr. Bank. It's all about the dad. And that's, you know, that's where this is at. And it's just, it's such a beautiful thing to watch. It is one of the most rewatchable movies I can think of.
Oh my gosh. Yes. It's in that category with Shawshank, or, you know, that the list is different for everybody, I think, but, one of those movies that, as you said, you can rewatch it, or if you, in the old days when we would tune around channels, if anybody remembers that, and you come across something that was playing already, and you get pulled right into it. And
that's a great observation, by the way, Jim, what you said about his dad having, you know, changing, because and maybe being in large part the dad's story, because, you know, the dad has had this, you know, the acknowledgement that finally that, wow, this is my son, and look at what my son accomplished. There's no greater gift, you know, if you're dad, than to be in there, to have that kind of pride in your son. And his pride was misplaced all these years, like it was football and gym. And this, well, I've had this kid under my roof, and I didn't appreciate how grand he is, you know, what he was capable.
Someone told me about being a parent. I have two kids, and they're all grown now. But somebody told me that there's a point in your life as a father, you grow up thinking you're the rocket. You are the rocket. You're the one that's gonna, you know, go to the moon and stuff. But as you get older and you have kids and you watch your kids grow up, it turns out you're the booster. You're the booster that pushes that rocket into space, and your kids are the rockets now. And you know, eventually they'll become boosters too. But it's just that shift in your life. And I think that's part of this thing that you watch with John Hickam as you're watching the movie, that he's not the main, like you said, he's not looking at himself, but he's suddenly noticing that this kid that he has living with him is that's the rocket that he's got to push. He's got to become his booster. It's just such a great story. Yeah. I'm so glad we're doing this movie as part of the podcast. Again, Lewis, I can't thank you enough for writing the screenplay and yes. and being a part of this, and also letting us have you on our show.
One of the things in life I'm always happy to talk about is October Sky, because I if you look at my IMDb, I've been fortunate enough to have got a lot of movies made, and there are none that turned out as well. I don't argue with people anymore. People like this. Oh, you wrote that? I love that movie. I said, okay, well, I'm glad you love it. But October Sky out of my canon is the one movie that I really do love. And it turned out beyond my imaginings. It's I feel like, as I get a lot older in life, what is my legacy? And I think, this is it, I'm not going to ever have anything as fine out there for generations to look at as October Sky. And, gives me a lot of peace as I get near the end.
Well, hopefully you get some more stories in you, because we do enjoy your films. I was saying before this with Hal that Flaming Hot was hilarious and very inspirational. I had a great time watching that.
Likewise.
Good.
Yeah, it was wonderful. Wow. Well, again, Lewis, thanks so much for being with us. For folks listening to this show, if this is your first time listening to our show, please like, subscribe, and leave a review at whatever streaming service you're listening to right now. Please catch up on previous episodes and social media info out there at our big site, octoberskyminute.com. We'll be back next time, so please join us here next time on the October Sky Minute.
Blow yourselves up.